contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, Somehow Airline Customer Service is Getting Even Worse, by Mac Sherwin. And this is from the technology section. In early 2020, when the coronavirus was still a distant concern, my wife and I booked an AirAsia flight to Bali. Big mistake. At the start of the lockdown, we scrambled to secure a refund. We called the airline's customer support line. No dice. We pleaded with its online chatbot, a lobotomized character named Ava. We sent a Twitter message to the brand on March 17th and received a response 7 weeks later that read in full, quote, Twitter feedback. Those were dark days in airline customer service, with so many travelers desperate to figure out alternative plans. The present is not much brighter. In recent months, airlines around the world have changed how they engage with customers who need help. Frontier will no longer take your call, encouraging flyers to make contact via chatbot. Alaska Airlines is removing check-in kiosks at certain airports, driving people to its app. Air France, KLM, and Ryanair have all suspended customer service on Twitter, which for a time may have been the quickest way to summon a living, breathing employee. As Twitter melts down and people flee Facebook, social media just isn't as useful as it once was for airline customer service. At the same time, airlines are leaning into AI, betting that the latest wave of chatbots will be the most cost-effective way to support customers. The long-standing truth is that companies don't want to talk to you. First, they didn't want to do it in person. Then they didn't want to do it by phone. Now they don't want to do it online, and soon they won't want to do it at all. It's not personal. It just costs money. But hype-fueled AI products have yet to pick up the slack. A chatbot being able to talk and learn and suggest and persuade and do all of these things that humans can do? I haven't seen it in action personally. Eva Eskarza, a co-founder of the Customer Intelligence Lab at Harvard Business School, told me. Airline customer service is caught between two eras of the internet, one built on social media, the other on machine learning. The transition promises to be rocky. If you're traveling this summer, you better hope that you don't need help from an airline. Airlines belong to a category of customer-facing businesses that marketers call high touch. They deal with customers whose needs are constantly evolving. Flights are delayed, bags get lost, people have to change their plans. And customers feel they deserve a certain level of care. After all, despite its gradual democratization, air travel remains quite expensive, especially in this period of high inflation. Multiply passenger expectations by the total number of seats. Delta flies something like the population of Sacramento every day on average, and you start to appreciate the sector's complexities. These daunting customer service demands have pushed airlines to automate since the dawn of mainframes. In 1960, IBM and American Airlines launched the first computerized reservation tool based on a program developed for the Air Force. Customers would call a travel agent, who would then call an airline ticketing agent, who would then input the trip particulars. By 1964, the system could process some 7,000 bookings an hour, at a time when ticketing agents working manually could process one or two. The problem is we're still using it. The basic systems, which said Box A talks to Box B via telex, have largely remained unchanged since the 1950s, Timothy O'Neill Dunn, an airline industry consultant, told me. He paused to make sure I knew what a telex was. It's a fax for text messages. So we are dealing with very, very old tech, he added. That old tech speaks in short codes, confirmation numbers, airport initials, seat numbers, passenger types. Customers rarely know all of the data that apply to their itinerary. which meant that until the advent of more advanced AI in recent years, changing a flight or locating a bag required a human intermediary, someone fluent in airline and English, who could translate a question and input it as DL754, ATL, 19B, and Y. But call centers are expensive, even in Manila. Mindsay, a company that develops conversational AI for the industry, estimates that each call support call costs airlines $2.20. In 2017, Harvard Business Review pegged the average cost of a live customer service interaction at three times that amount. Over the past decade, Facebook and Twitter emerged as efficient alternatives, allowing airlines to automate their response to certain posts and messages while paying special attention to the most urgent issues, or in some cases, the highest profile users. In some ways, airlines demonstrated the viability of extending customer service over social media. If they could do it, any brand could. A study last year by the customer experience company Amplify found that among 23 industries, airlines had the second fastest average customer response time. In many cases, tweeting at an airline can really result in shorter wait times than sternly repeating representative on the phone or running a gauntlet of scripted if-then scenarios with an online text box. Until recently, that kind of automated sorting was the best the chatbots, which many airlines offered early versions of, could muster. The predominant use case for AI in customer service was the prioritization of calls, the prioritization of requests. As Karza said, software that decided how long you could wait for human assistance before the big vein in your head popped. On the other side of Twitter sat a flesh-and-blood airline agent whose voice was never heard but keenly felt. You could tweet something salty, tag the airline, and soon get an invitation to DM from an agent who invariably signs their name. But customer service through social media has become strained. "Can you calm down and allow me some time to work, please?" Delta tweeted to an inquiring customer last year. During the pandemic, airlines struggled to handle the unprecedented volume of passengers upset by endless rescheduling, and they doubled down on their automation efforts. In 2020, Delta temporarily suspended its customer service on Twitter and Facebook amid agent shortages and increased wait times. KLM, which was fielding 50,000 Facebook messages a day that March, enhanced its chat box with machine learning. The discount carriers WestJet and AirAsia leaned into their existing ones. Not all bots were created equal. AirAsia CEO Tony Fernandez recently called Ava, my erstwhile nemesis, the most hated AI chat bot in Southeast Asia. Nevertheless, it worked in the aggregate, at least from the brand's point of view. During COVID, Ava helped clear millions of cases that would not have been possible given the amount of requests, Fernandez said in an emailed statement. That was all before the implosion of Twitter under Elon Musk. Twitter has begun charging companies $1,000 a month to integrate their customer service into the app, prompting Air France and other companies to reconsider the site altogether. Meanwhile, the rise of platforms like TikTok, which aren't as conducive to customer engagement, have undermined social media support even further. Those trends, along with recent strides in generative AI, have emboldened airline executives. Air India has committed $200 million to update its digital systems, which will include ChatGPT-driven features. Frontier claims that its self-service model requires less labor and delivers better customer service experiences, although in a recent investigator report, the airline baldly states its interest in limiting avenues for customer negotiation. In February, AirAsia replaced Ava with a new bot called Ask Bo, which it promises will be more proactive and attentive thanks to enhanced AI. Technical details are scant, although a spokesperson for the airline claims that since Bo's launch, 95% of all customer queries have flowed through it, and 73% of those queries were resolved with no follow-up. Considering how eagerly airlines have leaned into automation, expect other carriers to soon follow suit. Airlines look on the face of it to be an ideal place to start to deploy an AI-based chatbot powered by the latest large language models, O'Neill Dunn said. These days, even when you appeal to airlines over social media, you're likely triggering some kind of machine learning program. Both Twitter and Meta have invested in automation features for brands fielding customer messages. I just get a link, and then I'm starting this WhatsApp conversation, as Carza said. Sometimes I know it's a bot, sometimes not. She pointed out that although research suggests customers prefer human interaction, it's often because they lack compelling alternatives. That's starting to change, and the ancillary features of AI support may suit us just fine. On a text-based interface, it's okay to be short, as Carza said, and it's okay not to be polite, and it's okay to just get to the point. But the freedom to jettison social niceties is a shallow benefit. The simple reality is that customer service has eroded on social media, while the AI programs meant to replace it don't yet meet the burdens of air travel. The last wave of chatbots, such as Swiss's Nelly and WestJet's Juliet, could clear the most straightforward cases with brute force, but they could also be blundering and ineffective. Airlines have iterated on those models and introduced new and improved versions, like Ask Bo, looking to capitalize on the fresh interest in AI as so many other companies are. Still, sophisticated bots on the level of ChatGPT don't widely exist in air travel, and the way that airlines will actually deploy them, however many months or years from now, is an open question. For now, as the social web recedes from view and AI stumbles into an uncertain growth spurt, consumers everywhere are falling through the cracks. In the long run, AI might improve customer experiences more than it degrades them. As airlines build smarter and smoother chatbots, they may free up their dwindling labor force to deal with a smaller percentage of the more complicated requests. If chatbots are already capable of so much, why couldn't they help us deal with a canceled flight or a lost bag? But AI could reshape customer service in more insidious ways. O'Neill Dunn noted that as their customer service tools become more nuanced, airline offerings are going the other way, giving rise to unbundled amenities and pared-down services, like some basic economy tickets that don't let you pick your seat without a surcharge. If the product is simpler, the servicing is easier, he said. On the back end, AI could assess the value of every request, including if and when customers should receive help at all. The decision of who not to serve is as important as who to serve, as Carza said. One logical outcome for an airline with millions of customers might be to simply deny or ignore a percentage of all complaints, which already happens with maddening frequency. The only thing worse than a feckless chatbot is a chatbot telling you, with perfect cogence and clarity, to get lost. Today's second article is from Science. You Don't Have to Cremate Your Cat, by Eleanor Cummins. When a pet is dying, many people reach out to their veterinarian one last time. By default, many vets double as undertakers, passing on a pet's body to a regional crematorium that accepts animal remains. The owner pays the vet a fee for the arrangements, and the crematorium may return the remains in a small urn, an unassuming memorial to a lost companion. Pet cremation has been common in the United States for decades now. Some of the first dedicated facilities popped up in the 1970s and 80s as the practice slowly gained purchase among humans. Since then, cremation has become so much the default for pets and humans alike that many owners aren't aware they have other options. Donna Shugart Bethune, the executive director of the International Association of Pet Cemeteries and Crematories, told me, but animals remain on the leading edge of death care. Techniques first used to handle the remains of livestock and lab animals have become more common for well-loved pets. One such tactic, called alkaline hydrolysis, involves rapidly decomposing a body in a stream of water. So-called aquamation has the advantage of offering pet owners a futuristic, planet-friendly alternative to cremation and burial. Although sustainability is hardly the first thing anyone thinks of when a beloved dog or cat dies, these decisions quickly add up. No one burial or a cremation extracts such a terrible toll on the environment, but in the aggregate, the remains of pets and humans have a significant impact. One major cost of cremation is the carbon dioxide these flaming chambers release. Burial may look simple, may look better, if pets are interred in a pine box or some other natural container, the animal's body will decompose rapidly, says Ed Martin, vice president of the Hartsdale Pet Cemetery. But metal or plastic containers will sit in the soil for decades. Among the more taxing impacts of burial is when land is permanently set aside for graves, rather than, say, for forests or prairies, and those graves are artfully maintained using significant amounts of water, pesticides, and more. Of course, burying a fish in the backyard doesn't have a global land use impact, but many Americans don't have their own land for a burial or live someplace where backyard burials are impossible. Aquamation, by contrast, is compact and efficient and generates no direct emissions of its own, making it one of the greenest means of final disposition. The process is fairly simple. Over a 20-hour cycle, alkalized water decomposes all of the body's proteins and fats. The water drains into the local wastewater system. When the timer dings, all that is left of the pet are the bones, which an operator removes and pulverizes as one would in a typical flame cremation. Staff may also return those remains to the owner. By some estimates, aquamation has about one-tenth of the environmental impact of flame cremation, or, if operators purchase their electricity from renewable sources, even less. At Resting Waters, a boutique pet funeral home in West Seattle, sisters Jocelyn Roth and Darcy Bernard aquamate a few thousand animals each year. They own and operate two machines, both manufactured by BioResponse Solutions, that have capacities of 100 pounds and 400 pounds, respectively. That allows the company to aquamate anywhere from 1 to 28 small animals, arranged in their own individual Tetris-like pod at a time. Services range from $90 for the smallest critters to $550 for bigger animals and end up costing more than typical flame cremation. Today, there are about 400 animal aquamation machines in the world, says Samantha Cyber, the vice president of BioResponse Solutions, including about 20 supersized systems for horses. Many regions in the U.S. have dedicated, easily located pet aquamation companies with competitive prices. In the future, vets might offer the service directly. It's a great model for veterinarians to be able to offer and cut out the middleman, Roth told me. No matter what path a pet owners choose, memorialization is possible. At Hartsdale Pet Cemetery, owners typically choose large stone headstones similar in design to those in human cemeteries, but more expressive. Engraved silhouettes, enameled photos of pets in life, engraved nicknames, and religious symbols abound. When you walk around here, there's a lot of whimsy, Martin, the vice president of the cemetery, told me. The same is true of pet urns, which can be customized in innumerable ways, including with paw prints or nose prints. But there are more sustainable and less expensive ways of honoring a beloved pet, too. Resting Waters will clean and prepare pets for viewing before they are placed in the aquamation chamber. People also ask for fur or whisker clippings, and sometimes for whole bones instead of crushed remains. In-person or Zoom funerals, attended by close friends and family, can help owners grieve, and funeral offerings are always changing as the industry responds to the needs of consumers. Whereas human death care can feel locked in by tradition, Roth observed that there's something about our pets that gives us agency. Today, alkaline hydrolysis is an option for animals nationwide and is legal for humans in 28 states, although it's not always available. It's the most recent evidence that the death of our animals helps us experiment with new ways to channel our grief and imagine our own death. Next, The Single Greatest Hindrance to Learning, by Connor Friedersdorf. Last week, I asked readers if parents should stop giving their children smartphones before high school. Replies have been edited for length and clarity. Eric is a teacher. He writes, Cell phones are the single biggest addiction, obsession, and obstacle to learning, maturing, and socializing that I have seen in almost 20 years as an educator. Most students, hell, most adults, are powerless to resist the temptation to stay continually connected to their phones. Students know better than anyone just how distracting and disruptive they are, and, if being honest, will almost unanimously say they are better students and people when their phone is out of sight. The fact that more schools do not help students by removing this single greatest hindrance to the educational experience that we have ever seen is baffling, and it will not be seen favorably by those who look back at it. Elizabeth is the mother of 9-year-old twins. We are in Barcelona this year, and my daughters attend a school where phones are not allowed. They simply tell students to leave their phones at home. Kids play and talk during recess. The second day of school, I arrived to take my daughters to an appointment. I found them walking around the school yard, holding hands with a new best friend, chatting and giggling. When I left with my daughters, all the other girls in the class clustered around to say goodbye. This school also has 3 45-minute periods of recess during the day in addition to a lunch hour, so there's lots of time for socialization and minimally supervised play. Right after smartphones came onto the market, we didn't know the effects on children and teens or adults. Now that the effects on mental health, attention, and learning have become clear, there's bound to be a sea change where more and more parents won't allow children and teens smartphones. I've told my kids they can have a smartphone when they can afford to buy one and pay for their own monthly plan. I will buy them a dumb phone when they are 16 and driving by themselves. Until then, they have a landline, an analog watch, a time that they should be back home, and the freedom to roam the neighborhood. Ben is going to be a senior in high school and writes that everyone I know, myself included, are addicted to their phones. He continues, my parents did not let me get a phone until sixth grade. Having a phone in middle school is basically a necessity. And no social media until 10th, far later than most of my peers. While frustrating at the time, my parents made the right call. I've seen kids become depressed over social media, watched it end relationships, and seen it make many people detached from reality. When I got social media, I was mature enough to use it, and waiting to use it has lessened my addiction to it. I have elementary-age siblings, and seeing fourth or fifth graders with a phone will never stop being weird. I understand why parents give their children phones. It makes sense at the time because their kids are always at practice or at a friend's house. But 5 years later, in middle or high school, the addiction is so strong that most kids can't go a single class period without being on their phone. And I know the amount of time and energy that female friends and people I've been in relations with spend on having the perfect Instagram profile. Parents refusing to give a phone before high school will only cause resentment and some social isolation. But phones should not be given to elementary schoolers. Social media should not be allowed before high school. And once there, access should be based on maturity. These technologies rule my friends and my relationships and time. And while it's not exactly a bad thing, everyone I know occasionally wishes it would just all go away. Tanner was given a smartphone at 13 and writes, prior to that, I wrote often and loved creating stories. As soon as I could access social media and the internet from the palm of my hand, I stopped writing. It seemed so laborious and unsatisfying compared to the instant gratification and stimuli available on my phone. Now in my late 20s, I've finally curbed my smartphone use and have started writing again. But I will always regret the decade I spent glued to my phone instead of creating. One of my biggest fears with smartphones is that they are stifling a generation of writers, musicians, philosophers, artists, scientists, inventors, and all sorts of other creative professionals. Creativity comes from moments of boredom and idleness. Smartphones eliminate so many of those moments. Creativity also requires an open, curious, inquisitive mind. I think young people will struggle to develop such a mind when using smartphones to constantly consume vapid, worthless content that usually lacks artistic merit. B, an administrator at an international school in South Korea, noticed a troubling phenomenon. Every year, more and more students, even responsible, high-performing ones, do not know how to navigate basic social situations. I will prompt students to do a simple task, and a substantial portion will simply stare at me as if I said nothing. This is not defiance, at least not in a traditional sense. It's more like a catatonic response induced, I believe, by being unfamiliar with or even overwhelmed by real-world interactions. The same students will be upbeat and engaged and show dynamic facial expressions the second they're permitted to look at their phones. My school has an extensive outdoor education program. All students go on multi-day outdoor trips, and they cannot bring phones with them at all. For the first 5 or 6 hours, many of the kids are miserable. But eventually something flips. When truly separated from their phones, the kids begin to talk to each other, play games, and engage even with the teachers. There is still evidence of social handicap during these interactions, but the difference is remarkable. I find hope that even the heavily phone-addicted teenagers of Korea can show signs of basic sociability with a short-term separation from their phones. The lesson I learned from this, if a few days away from smartphones can make unsociable teens interact with a semblance of humanity, responsive parents should give their children a childhood free from the devices entirely. Robert recently began teaching at a public school in North Carolina. He writes, "My first day, I told another science teacher that I had bought a storage rack for the students to deposit their phones into before entering the classroom. She was surprised and strongly urged me to reconsider, telling me this would be like cutting off their arms. Although I found her analogy disturbing, I had no experience teaching high school and reluctantly took her advice. This was by far the worst teaching decision I made. I became a cell phone cop. I would make the first announcement to put their phones away at the beginning of every class and then proceed to spend the next 90 minutes trying to enforce it. I caught them cradling their phones in their laps, holding them under their desks, using them to cheat on tests and quizzes, and leaving them in their backpacks but listening to them through their AirPods. One of the projects we did was to analyze the impact of the time they spent on their phones. The average daily screen time for students in my classes for the month of April was 9.5 hours, with a mean of 285 pickups." We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.